Welcome to the Super Fantastic Nerd Hour. It's episode 3. We're talking Ready Player One.
I'm H.A. Conrad, here with my co-host.
This is Ali Matu, and we're going to dive into the super nerdy Ready Player One book.
Super awesome.
Super awesome nerd. The super fantastic nerdy Ready Player One. We've got a pretty cool infinite crossover today. What are we doing, Conrad?
We are doing Wade versus Scott Pilgrim.
Oh my gosh.
In the infinite crossover chamber. I think it should be a pretty interesting contest and debate.
And if that's not cool enough already, we've got a really fun top five today. We're counting down the top five, our favorite top five nostalgia media.
Right. And we're playing with the term media a little bit, I'd say. At least I did in my top five.
I think we just had a hard time just squeezing it to one genre, and we wanted to share a lot of we got really nostalgic this week, wanted to share a lot of our favorite stuff. So it'll be fun.
Great. It's a good show ahead. So
let's
I'm very excited.
Yeah. So how did you discover Ready Player One?
Actually, it was recently, and I'm surprised that I had not heard about it before, given my nerdy, geeky tendencies. I wouldn't call myself a gamer, but I have had obsessions with certain games in my life. And as a lot of people who have seen my Atari photo can attest, this is, something that definitely is deeply imprinted on my personal psyche and experience.
If you haven't seen that photo, go to superfantasticnerdhour.com, click on About, and there you'll see Conrad in all of her Atari
glory.
Glory.
But I was actually at my partner's birthday party, and a very good friend of ours, Dan Gottesman, mentioned Ready Player One. And he even said, I'm surprised you haven't heard of this, Conrad, and recommended it. And then you, Ali, also mentioned it to me. So I picked it up on my handy dandy Kindle, and I couldn't put it down. I finished it in a day, I think.
Which is kind of normal for Conrad. One of the things I'm envious of is your superpower of just gobbling books. You are able to read books at a very fast pace. I'm a pretty slow reader, so I'm always very jealous of your super ability.
Well, it's a couple of things. I have a commute that allows me to have uninterrupted reading time. Mm-hmm. And depending on how interested I am in a book is also part of the reading factor. Yes, I think I read faster than a lot of people, but I think it also is helped along if the book is something I'm into. And this was definitely a book I was into.
Yeah, and I think that'll be a lot of people's kryptonite, is trying to read something that's boring. Having been in school for so long, I can definitely attest to that. I found out about Ready Player One a long time ago. Hmm. Back in, I think the book came out 2011, or was it 2010?
I think it's 2010.
2010. And it was a lot of people and a lot of podcasts I listened to were talking about it.
Oh, no, you're correct.
2011, yeah. Mm-hmm. I first heard about it on This Week in Tech, Leo Laporte's awesome podcast. And I looked at it. I was in a book club with my roommates in grad school at the time, and I kept bringing it up. And they were like, no, let's actually read some more classic literature. So we didn't get around to it. And I was always putting it off because it had been hyped so much in my mind. So many people were talking about how this is like the ultimate nerd book and you must read this. How have you not read it? And a good friend of mine on Twitter, friend of mine in real life and also on Twitter, Jose Cardona, who's at Geek Therapist, sent me a tweet a couple weeks ago and said, hey, have you read this yet? And I said, no. And he kind of pressured me into it by saying, let's do a Twitter book club. So if you look up hashtag geek book club, I think our tweets about this come up. So that's kind of how I got into it. What really sold me on it is when Josue said, Will Wheaton does the audiobook.
Yeah.
And, I'm not the fastest reader, but I'm I just gobble up audio, and I have a really good memory for listening to things. So I listened to the audiobook on my commute, which is shorter than yours. It's about 15-20 minutes, but my listening time would extend throughout all hours of the day because I was hooked on this book.
So you audiobooked it as opposed to reading it.
I did, and you read it on ebook.
Right, I read it on my Kindle Paperwhite.
So neither of us really read it in paper, which I think is fitting with the story.
Right. Yeah. We should also mention the author of this book is Ernest Klein.
Mm-hmm.
And he is admittedly and obviously, into pop culture and is obsessed with certain things, such as Back to the Future and video games. And obviously this all... This book,
music of the 70s.
Right, and it's music of the 70s, 80s.
Partially 80s, yeah.
And this book is definitely, I don't want to call it a fanboy's homage to all these things, but it kind of is. And
it's a celebration.
It's a celebration.
It's a celebration of all of the things that he loves. And as he is a nerd among nerds and is definitely, if at all you... have had exposure to any of the things that he likes, there's a good chance you're going to enjoy the book.
Right. So without further ado, are you ready to do our review?
Let's do it. And we should give a spoiler alert. We're going to dive into it. We are going to reveal some plot points. So if you want to remain absolutely novice to the story, this is the time to hit the pause button. Go download it on your Kindle or go buy the book, audiobook, or
the paper book.
Or the paper book. Go to your paper bookstore, support your local bookstore. But we're going to go into spoiler town now.
Okay. Let's go.
So what's the gist of the story, Conrad?
Well, the gist of the story is the world at this point, the year is 2044. And basically... The Earth is not faring very well. All of our...
The humans on the Earth aren't
Yes,
faring.
The humans and the Earth. Yeah. Our resources are depleted. It's not... I don't think it would be wrong to call it a wasteland, but it's definitely not a happy thing.
It's a dystopia.
Yeah, it's definitely a dystopia. Yeah, it is. And our main
character...
The
real life is dystopia.
Right. And within this world... Oasis, which is a multiplayer online game system, it's a simulation system, has been created by this creative James Halliday. And he basically has created this. People take refuge in this game because the world is pretty horrible. And it's free for people to be in this world. And pretty much anything you want to do within this world, you can do it. There, people, and there's currency within this world, so it brings to mind things like Second Life and things like that.
It's sort of a mashup of massively online role-playing games and things like Second Life and, other stuff that has yet to come, but it's got this cool technology where you have these visors that, depending on how great your computer system is, they produce real-life or near-real-life imagery. You have these haptic gloves or full-body haptic suits, which give you feedback on what you're touching and interacting with in the game. So it's a pretty immersive simulation.
Right. And, there is currency within the game so that as you do different challenges within the universe, you can earn currency and basically use it to buy... basically cars and food and things within the Oasis universe.
And that's how they make money is
right.
You have online merchants and you have anything you can buy in the offline world, you buy in the real, or you can buy in Oasis.
Right.
And there's other aspects to it too, where if you want to be able to transport to other planets, you can pay to transport and beam instantly there, or you can run there or fly in your craft there, and then you can upgrade your crafts. And so there's a lot of ways in which you can spend money.
Right.
And that's important because our protagonist is not a guy who really has a lot of money. Wade Watts is one of these guys living in these stacks, living in kind of these stacked mobile home kind of things. And he's kind of this 18-year-old kid who spends a lot of his time as Parsifal in Oasis.
Right. And the creator, James Halliday, of this whole world, the premise or the whole sort of challenge behind this book is that the creator has died. And when he died, he left a video will basically saying that anybody who could collect three keys in Oasis and basically go through three gates related to these keys would inherit his entire fortune, which it's in the billions, and also a controlling stake of his company, which also means that they would be in charge of the whole Oasis. So, of course, in this terrible world, everybody wants to do this. It's very much a Willy Wonka
challenge. That's exactly
challenge.
What I was thinking, yeah. Yeah.
And a golden ticket, if you will. And so Wade Watts, or Parzival, I guess we should call him as well, he is one of the people that is just dedicated to finding this. And he and other people who are trying to do this are called Gunters, which is a combination of egg hunters. So it's, you know, the Easter eggs within in the universe.
The story really takes off from there. You're following Parzival. He's got a friend named H. It's his encounters meeting up with this person he's following on the blogs and YouTube, which still exists in this world, called Artemis. So he's a big fan of Artemis. It's their adventures. You got the villain that comes into play, which is the IOI company, who's trying to take control of the Oasis. And it's kind of a race to the end to see who's going to find the Easter egg, but also the adventure and the journey that Parzival goes on.
Right.
So I've really, really been curious to hear your thoughts on the book. How did you like it? What was your experience reading it?
I honestly, it was delightful to read. I enjoyed every second of it. There were little mentions. This is a geek after my own heart, I guess, is the way to put it. But he mentions certain like different films and even different bad films in a nostalgic way are sometimes great. One of these things that he mentions is Lady Hawk. He mentions that film, and that's a Matthew Broderick, Rutger Hauer film. Mm-hmm. Michelle Pfeiffer, actually, as well. Mm. And it was terrible, but terribly great. And I just love that he threw that mention in there. There's a War Games aspect.
There's a big War Games moment, which I know is a movie that's really important to your partner.
It is. It is. And I like that movie as well. Let's not, I love that movie. But, you know, there's all these things that quite honestly were part of my growing up, part of what makes me the person I am today. He pretty much hit on all of that and, you know, set my nostalgia factor just kind of like pinging that piece of my psyche. So including the video games like he mentions and some of like, the music he mentions and things like that. I just enjoyed this book from beginning to end.
You know, you're talking about nostalgia. There are, you know, Pac-Man is a big part. Schoolhouse Rock, Mecha Godzilla, Ultraman. There are so many references. Joust. There's, you know, a lot of moments.
Back to the Future.
Back to the Future with the DeLorean. Blade Runner features in a key moment in this book. So you're absolutely right. The nostalgia was pinging and pinging and pinging. You know, so I started reading the book and really got interested in this world he had created, the virtual world he created, Oasis. And one of my favorite things about this book is how that world works. I wish I could spend some time just exploring it, because he has a really, he kind of devised an amazing way to make these worlds interact with each other.
Right.
Where there's certain zones, and you could be in the Star Wars zone where Force exists. But if you travel from the Star Wars zone to the Star Trek zone, the Force is not going to work anymore.
Right. And then there's certain zones where magic and science all work together.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's an example of like if your spaceship breaks down in a magic zone, you might have to hire a wizard to come and cast a spell to get your ship fixed. And I love the way these different genres got mashed up, and there was a logic to how they were going to interact.
There was, and it was a well thought out universe. Mm-hmm. He really put a lot of work into this and into how a person would interact in this sort of universe, how they would make connections. For example, the main character, Wade Watts, him and his friend H often meet in this basement that H has created, and it's basically a secret meeting room, invite only.
Yeah.
And you can have private meetings in there. Nobody can access this, so you think. But it's, you know, people creating these little pocket places of safety for themselves. It's really just all explained very well. I was left with, you know, you're always left with a few questions in these sorts of stories because it's so very detailed.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh my goodness, I felt like his research was just incredible.
The labor of love that the author went into is really touching and striking. How much he shows so much respect and love to these different movies and books and games. And reading it, this was part of my hesitation why I didn't want to read the book at first, because I've heard this before. Lee, you'll love this. This is for you. And I've heard that with Big Bang Theory.
That's going to have to be another show because I just cannot deal with that.
This is a huge topic. But I was recently reading an article about Big Bang Theory, and one of the complaints about it is these geeks on that show are hyper-intelligent, yet also super socially impaired, and have a love of everything, everywhere in geek and nerd culture. And that's not realistic. You know, we all like certain things, and there's certain things we don't like. And just because someone is a geek doesn't mean they like Game of Thrones and Star Trek and Star Wars and all these video games. So I was afraid it might be something that is trying to play on that idea. And
you know what? It could have gone there. It easily could have gone there, but I think he kept it pretty focused.
He really honors it.
He does.
It's not... It is kind of... I really feel like it's more autobiographical of his loves, and that shines through in the book, and I'm glad he didn't try to squeeze in everything.
Right.
And it is the 70s and 80s kind of time frame.
Still a bit of 90s in there, too.
There's some 90s here and there, stuff that he liked. But it's not everything. It's not all encompassing. And I didn't get a lot of the references, and there's a lot I got, but I never felt like it was being inauthentic or it was trying to capitalize on sort of geek culture or anything
right.
like that.
One of the things I did think about it, and you know, aside from being a really fun story, a really fun hero's quest story, was sort of ideas about nostalgia. In some ways, he's playing with that idea. The main creator of Oasis, James Halliday, is a little bit cut off from a lot of the world. There's a mention that he may have Asperger's syndrome, that part of why he created the Oasis was because he just didn't feel very accepted within the real world, except by his co-creator, Oz, as they call him. whose name is Og, or Oz, I guess. I called him Oz because he took on, you know, a couple of people
kinda
mentioned
reminds
that.
You, yeah.
But Ogden Morrow is his co-creator, and even he got estranged from James Halliday, who goes by the name of Anorak.
Anorak, yeah, that's great.
In the Oasis. And it's sort of playing upon this idea. There are some very serious themes within this, and they're explored with James Halliday hiding from the world in the Oasis, and also with Wade Watts and some of the other characters hiding in the Oasis. And that, to me, brought up some things like, why do we like all these things that are so nostalgic? What is it that makes us keep going back to it? And what is the line? What is the line of really enjoying and just sort of having that moment of, oh, I remember that,
yeah,
to hiding in that and not wanting to try new experiences?
Well, the thing you were talking about with the pinging of nostalgia over and over in this book and how it kept you glued, that's kind of how nostalgia works. the psychologist Jamie Madigan runs this great website, which everyone should check out, The Psychology of Video Games. And he wrote an article recently about video game nostalgia. And that really dives into all of this and how nostalgia is, it's kind of a part of this psychological immune system where we think of old memories. And we tend to think about, it's not just the video game, but it's the social relationships around it, playing with your friends, playing with a sibling. Like, a lot of the memories for me that were being triggered is playing all these video games with my brother. Because this, a lot of the generation of this stuff is a little bit older than me, and my brother was older than me, and he exposed me to a lot of this stuff. So a lot of fond memories come up, and it's a way of reminding you of social relationships that are important, about repairing social relationships, about putting in energy into your current relationships. And the other thing about nostalgia is our positive memories tend to fade slower than our negative ones. So what kind of remains years and years later are these pleasant memories of the experiences you had in the past about the stuff that you love.
That you're looking at somewhat through the rose-colored glasses. And what it also brought, for me, what it brought to mind is, and I know this could be entering into dangerous territory for a lot of people, but when the Star Wars prequels were announced, and they said...
I know where you're going.
And they said they were going to re-release episode one, you know, all the...
The original trilogy.
The
special editions.
In theaters. And everybody...
Fantastic trailer.
Right. And everybody
was... If you've
only
seen Star Wars on TV screen, you haven't seen it all. Da, 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 da.
And I did. I had that level of excitement, as did many of my friends.
Yeah.
We went we bought advanced tickets to go into the theaters to see this. Waited online at midnight to see episode four. And then we sat down and it wasn't the Star Wars that we remembered because it had been altered. And...
This was not the Star Wars you were looking for.
This was not the Star Wars I was looking for. And while I still really enjoyed it, and I definitely had a negative reaction. I didn't understand why you would even bother doing this, because this is what the audiences had come to see, was the Star Wars that they remembered from their childhood. And George Lucas had added in some different things. And, you know, in his mind, I think he improved it. But I don't think they were quite expecting the reaction from the fans that happened.
That from that generation of fans.
Right.
Yeah.
I think other people who had never seen it before didn't quite have that reaction. They're kind of like, oh, that's interesting, whatever. But people who grew up with that, this was an attack on their childhood.
Well, it was an attack on nostalgia.
Right.
And the Star Wars special editions are a really interesting example of what happens when you might revisit things that you have very fond memories of. And sometimes we watch old TV shows that we really liked and we revisit them and we're like, ooh, this wasn't that good. I'm going to stop because I don't want to ruin my memories of this. And because it's different than I remember. And I think that different than I remember is exactly what was coming up for you when you watched the special editions all over again.
Well, it was. And then, you know... Han shot first and all that fun stuff.
Yeah.
But I think that is what spawned things like The People versus George Lucas.
Oh, that documentary, which kind of dives into this whole phenomenon.
And if you watch it and people are getting so passionate and so upset and they're saying some very, if you were George Lucas, this would be just a horrible thing to have to go through and listen to. Not that George Lucas really cares, but I mean... he doesn't need to care about that. But I know that reactions from some people that had not had this experience watching these films as children, and it wasn't a part of that, were kind of like, these people are crazy.
Yeah.
But I think that's why it spawned such a passionate reaction from people, is that this was an assault on their memories, their sacred memories.
Yeah. And, you know, as a guy who doesn't remember going to see Star Wars in the movie theater, I was less upset about the special editions because I watched them on the TV screen and I just thought it was cool to be watching in the movie theater. So my experience was a little bit different than yours. And the other thing I think this taps into is the whole idea of formative years.
Right.
And a lot of research has shown that, you know, your teenage years is when a lot of your social relationships become such a huge part of your life and exposing you to new ideas, new music, new media. And the 20s is when things really kind of gel and formalize. And I think Star Wars was probably a big part of your formative years and probably a lot of your major memories and experiences and ideas. And it was just a little bit different experience for me. So I didn't have quite as the strong reaction. And I think it's George Lucas's work. I think he can change it however he likes. And what's interesting about Star Wars is George Lucas has had a way of reintroducing it into the public consciousness every like 10 years or so.
Well,
new generations of fans.
I'm not arguing with
in.
You. I think it's his work, but I also think he should leave the originals out there somewhere in some form. And he has not done that.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But back to our subject. With Ready Player One, I think that this, you're correct. I think it has something to do with formative years, which is why the nostalgia pings go off with this particular book. But because of that, and because of, I mean, he does cast a pretty wide net in terms of media and things like that. But I think that it isn't as accessible to some people as it could be, although I think people could definitely enjoy this. But I think that there's a reason why I specifically am reacting to some of the things. It's I don't know exactly how old Mr. Klein is, but I suspect he is a contemporary of mine.
It's probably an Xer, you know, and speaking as a millennial, it was a little bit more before my time. However, it was a lot of the stuff I got exposed through my older brother. And it wasn't inaccessible for me because I understand so much of what he talks about. I mean, he talks about a lot of video games I played, a lot of video games I played in arcades. And I grew up during that time where you had arcades that had a lot of new games that would cost 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
And then it had the cheap games that were 25 cents. And you could go play the older games like Joust, like Pac-Man,
right.
like those games. So I still got exposed to a lot of that stuff. But I got two big criticisms of the book, and one is the accessibility, just like you're talking about. I question whether this is a book that anyone could enjoy if you aren't steeped in all of these nerdy things.
Maybe, but the other thing, I was thinking that as well, and perhaps that is the case, but I think that that's who he wrote the book for.
Yeah, that's okay. That's the audience.
People, I don't think, and I think he must have written this for all the geeks that he knows, for himself. This was definitely a labor of love, and everybody doesn't need to love this, but I think if you are into this, and generally I think those are the people probably listening to our show, they are probably steeped in geek culture, you're going to love it. And I do highly recommend it. It's one of the most enjoyable books I have read in a good long while. I know that there were some criticisms that the gaming portions took over the book. I don't agree with that. I think he did a pretty good job at balancing that out. And so that even people who don't know those games would be interested.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, too, because there's enough description that you get the gist of it. I don't think that was a fair criticism. But getting back to what you said, I think Ernest Cline does. It's a fantastic love letter to the things that he loved. And so it's fine if you need to know this stuff to enjoy the book. That's fine, because a lot of people have. I mean, this book was a huge bestseller.
Well,
Warner Brothers has bought the rights to the movie the day it was released. And, you know, so I think a lot of this stuff is going to change in the movie version.
Well, it has to, because think of all the copyright.
All the rights, yeah.
And I did hear, and I believe he even said this, is that the War Games portion can't be used.
Yeah.
And I think they're using Better Off Dead instead of that, which is also a great film. But, you know, the War Games makes a lot more sense in the context of this
book.
So
there's going to be a lot of nostalgia for Warner Brothers properties in the movie. But here's, I think, I gotta want. There's two things with the way the book was written that are criticisms that I need to bring up. One is there's moments where it's exposition, 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 and there's a lot of explaining of things. And I found myself going, okay, I want more dialogue, because the dialogue and his interactions with the other people, the other avatars, is really interesting. And again, there's a great article on psychology of video games about the psychology of avatars and that stuff. I thought was well represented in the book. We don't have time to get into that, but we'll put it in the show notes. But a lot of exposition. And then I also thought the ending got a little preachy without really bringing it up too much. I think the book had this whole kind of tone and journey that it goes on. And then right at the end, there's this message about
living in the real world.
Living IRL.
Yeah.
And I thought that just kind of, it came out of nowhere, I felt like.
It was building a little bit, but I agree with you. It was a bit abrupt. And, you know, in some ways for me, it was not as believable about this specific character.
Did the exposition bother you, those periods of...
A little bit. Yeah. Although I feel like if you're going to make this accessible to some people, he does have to explain some of that stuff, because some of these things have not been... I mean, you've had a resurgence in some of this in a lot of these video games people have been exposed to now, because there has been that nostalgia factor, especially these old arcade games and things like that, and all the emulators that are now available to be able to play these. And you can play them at home. But sometimes it did get a bit long, and I agree. Sometimes the dialogue, the things that I wanted to see were not as meaty as they could have been.
Yeah.
But overall, I mean, he had an enormous sense of fun, I think, with writing this book. And that just shows, this is now past, but apparently in the printed versions of this book, Ernest Cline planted an Easter egg, and there were different words that were misspelled, and they basically added up to a clue, and people needed to, and a challenge, and a website, and
People had to go and find those video games and play these things kind of parallel.
Well, they had to play Joust.
They had to play Joust. And there was three challenges. Yeah. And
the winner of this particular challenge
got a DeLorean.
Right.
Which, oh my gosh.
You know, and Ernest Cline drives a DeLorean. So it's, you know, it's all pretty cool.
This is where, you know, any major criticism I have of the book, I'm going to forgive, because Ernest Cline is...
awesome.
He's one of us. He's one of us.
He is.
And I love that. And I love that he created something that honors all of this. You know, it made me kind of revisit a lot of this stuff. And I was playing emulator versions of some of these old games. And I got to say, some of the games hold up.
And some of them don't.
Some of them don't. I don't know if you've seen Conan O'Brien's series called Clueless Gamer. And so there's a great episode.
We'll put that in the show notes,
too. We'll put that in the show notes. And there's a great episode where he goes back and visits old Atari games. And he's a guy who hasn't played any games, so he's totally novice to this. And he's playing some of these games. And he's like, this is the worst thing I've ever done. This is the worst day of my life. I think only Space Invaders holds up.
Right.
But he plays things like Pitfall and kind of talks about how horrible this is. So... that I still enjoyed that, and going back and revisiting this stuff, discovering some of this stuff, watching some of the movies, the nostalgia going off the charts. I love the experience I had with this book, the things it led me to do, the conversations it started. I think it's a book that people are going to cherish for really generations to come.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a lot of fun and very well written. Very well thought out. And any issues that I have with it are pretty minor. I would recommend this to anybody who is a nerd like me. So
we give it the Super Fantastic Nerd Hour stamp of approval.
Indeed. But I don't want to let the time get away from us too much. So I think it is time to enter
the Infinite Crossover Chamber.
To the Infinite Crossover Chamber.
So today in the Infinite Crossover Chamber, our two adversaries are Wade Watts, although I think we should call him Parzival in this case.
Parzival, I think, fits, and he's going against Scott Pilgrim.
Indeed.
And we had a little bit of a debate. We're going to go with Scott Pilgrim from the graphic novel, and, you know, we might throw in a little bit of the movie there. They have a little bit of a different ending, but that's okay, because our question today kind of relates to all the versions of Scott Pilgrim and also Parzival from Ready Player One. And what is the main question today?
The main question is, if these two characters in their own worlds were to basically go head to head, which character is more successful in his quest?
So on the surface, you're like, okay, well, you got Parsifal who has to collect the Easter egg, and you've got Scott Pilgrim who has to defeat 7 evil exes to be able to go out with Ramona, mm-hmm. right? That's the surface level quest. But is there more to their quest that we really see in the stories?
Well, right, because obviously, or maybe not obviously, I think that there's dual quests going on for each of these characters. So on the outset, yes, these are the things that they need to go through. In Wade's case, it's to win the keys to the Oasis. In Scott Pilgrim's case, it's to win the heart of Ramona Flowers. But it's a lot deeper than that for both of them. And in fact, I think they both have somewhat similar quests, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Or deeper quests, I think that's the best way to put it. Because for Wade, it's basically finding some part of the real world or finding something to live for in the real world, having relationships in the real world, as opposed to just hiding out in the Oasis. Mm-hmm. And for Scott Pilgrim, I think it is
sort of confronting who he is,
right.
The things he's done, his past relationships, the
accountability,
the consequences of his actions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the journey that he sort of goes on.
Right. And figuring out these things as they're going. So,
and you know, I was really, we were originally going to go with the holodeck versus the Oasis, and then Conrad came up with this idea, and I loved the idea of mashing these two characters because they're both pinging your nostalgia, and Scott Pilgrim is a little bit more, the author of Scott Pilgrim is a little bit more of my generation, and so a lot of his references are more to the 90s.
And the Nintendo generation.
And the Nintendo generation, and Street Fighter, and uh-huh. a lot of that kind of stuff. So it was really reading the graphic novel, which I love how he's also mashing up manga and bringing in all these influences. And the movie, it was just pinging everything all over the place for me. So these characters, you could almost like see them sit down and play a video game together. Like, I think they would really get along. They go on very similar journeys here. And I'm having a really hard, tough time with this crossover because I'm not sure who completes your quest better.
Well, I mean, I just think some of what we were saying in terms of the ending of Ready Player One with Wade and how the closure and the preachy ideal things that happen at the end of the story, where he basically comes out of the Oasis, makes a connection with the girl, and says, oh, I have no need to go back to the Oasis.
However, he has been connecting with her throughout the book.
Right.
And throughout the story. It's not just at the end, but there's this question of, is this person I'm connecting with, is this person I'm developing a relationship in real life, what they're like online? And that's been an interesting kind of line of research now in psychology is, do we act the same online as we do offline? And it seems like for the most part we do, but that question comes up is, are these relationships that I'm developing real?
Right.
And that's part of the theme. And that's a little bit different for Scott Pilgrim because he's developing relationships. It's not as much about whether they're real or not, but the consequences of the people he invests in, the way he invests in people, and the way he hurts people. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, he's off running around with knives, chow.
That's one part of Scott Pilgrim. You know, we got a pretty big Asian American stereotype. Well, I guess Asian Canadian, I should say, stereotype of a character. That's one thing I don't like about Scott Pilgrim. However, yeah, the way he treats knives.
Well, and also the way he treats Ramona, because he technically is double timing. It is there in the film, but more so in the. It's mm-hmm. a huge central point in the graphic novel.
Yep.
And I mean, I think, honestly, you're correct. I think that there's difficulty in this crossover chamber because I think that they are almost equally matched in how they go through their quests and the things that they find out about themselves.
I think we're going to have to power up the structural integrity of the crossover. That might help us a little bit. Let me adjust the knobs here. Did that help at all?
No.
Oh, okay. Still tough. All right.
Although it was pretty awesome.
So,
but I mean, I think throughout the journey of the graphic novels with Scott Pilgrim, and there are scenes that surprise you within it, and his perception of the world, his perception of Ramona Flowers, his addressing certain things that he's done or has not done, as it turns out in some cases. I think that he goes from being just kind of this, you know, emo little boy to being an adult, to being a full-fledged functioning adult who's has to address some of the things that he's done, specifically with his exes.
Yeah. It's really about that transition from being a teenager to an adult and kind of realizing that the things you do have consequences. And I like that story. I got caught up in that story. And I think, you know, you talk about the idea of resilience and people who have experienced struggles, dealt with the consequences, are able to grow from it, and they're stronger moving forward. I think Scott Pilgrim is a guy who really deals with a lot of those issues. Now
I was actually just going to jump in because I think I now have a winner in my head. When you mentioned resilience. Because Wade Watts is in the world pretty much alone. His mother is dead. At some point in the book, anybody who he knows in real life has died.
Oh my gosh, I did not see that coming.
No.
My jaw dropped.
But even before that, he was functioning on his own. He's found a little place in the world to be able to access the Oasis. He's figured out a way to go to school in the Oasis so that he doesn't have to be dealing with awful people in the real world. And he's pretty much had to figure out this stuff. He has done it with the help of his friends in the Oasis. But to me, I think he has to win this challenge because he's had a much longer and torturous journey than Scott Pilgrim has. Scott Pilgrim has his friends. Scott Pilgrim has all these people that, despite him acting like a total tool, are still supporting him, as I guess we would hope people in our world would do that. But Wade doesn't have that. Wade is flying around having to figure out these things pretty much, you know, not on his own, but he does not have a safety net.
Now, okay, so what I will give you is there's that whole sequence where he goes into IOI headquarters, the arch enemy of, you know, the arch villain in the book, and does some pretty amazing things, really brilliant things there, makes a lot of risks. And yeah, so there he's a pretty resilient guy. The thing with Scott Pilgrim, though, is secret portals and all of that kind of stuff aside, a lot of his story is happening in real life. So the question for me comes up is, do Parsifal's skills translate to stuff that goes on outside the Oasis?
I would say it does, because even though the Oasis is the Oasis, you're still interacting with people. And if your premise that people act the same way online that they do in real life, then that takes away that entire aspect. Their interactions, they're just a different way of interacting. And I know there's a lot of people that say social media and all these things make people so that they're not they're becoming more and more isolated. But
that's not what the research is.
But I beg to differ, because you know what? There are people that I am now in contact with that I went to school with, my family members that are a world away, and I'm still able to be in contact with them in real time.
Yeah, I mean, the guy I met, Jose Cardona, who I met discussed earlier, we first met online and our friendship developed offline because of that. I give you that. However, I need to vote Scott Pilgrim because I just really love Scott Pilgrim. And
nice.
I'm running out of arguments to defend him.
We are at an impasse.
We are at an impasse. There is no mind meld on today's infinite crossover. But I think what we can agree with is we love both characters. And I'm wondering if this is just a generational thing, because I have such a fondness for Scott Pilgrim. And I'm wondering if it's just the nostalgia is pinging me harder.
Oh, no. This nostalgia pinged me for Scott Pilgrim, too. And, you know, I know that the film had a lot of critics. I love the film. I thought it was amazing. I can watch that film so many times. And there's little things in it that I just, oh, I adore it. And it's not just because I adore Edgar Wright, even though I do.
Oh, yeah.
But, no, it's an amazing film. I also think for people... Even people, this is the one difference I would say between these two pieces of media.
It's a little more accessible.
It's more accessible, even especially the film. Maybe not so much the graphic novel, but the film is much more accessible to the general public.
I think it's a story of growing up that a lot of people can relate to. So we like both. We're going to recommend both. And however, I think Scott Pilgrim wins.
No, Wade Watts wins. Barzival wins. Anyway.
All right, listeners, please let us know who you think would win and help us settle this super fantastic impasse.
Nerd impasse. Yeah. But now we need to exit the Infinite Crossover Chamber and move on to our respective top fives.
Top five nostalgia media. Nostalgia media. I have no idea where this top five is going to go.
Well, I mean, this is a pretty broad topic, so you and I may have defined it differently in our heads, which we will see. I took the nostalgia media to be things, you know, it could be films or TV shows, and there's one thing, one curveball I may throw in here that I may get flamed for, but things that are playing upon people's nostalgia, but also presenting... a time period or popular culture in a nostalgic way in order to ping those little neurons in everybody's heads and those connections.
So two things for that, two rules we had is one, which is also always a rule of us, things that we discuss in the crossover never qualify for the top five.
Right.
Otherwise, Ready Player One and Scott Pilgrim would be on the
obviously.
List. Obviously. It's a way of us squeezing in more items into our top five instead of it being a top
seven.
It's
a little bit of a cheat.
It's a cheat. It's a little bit of a game genie, if you will. The other thing is we wanted our picks to be specifically inducing nostalgia, trying to or being nostalgic as opposed to something that we have nostalgia for. So that's a little bit of a thing to remember as how we got to our picks.
Right.
You want to start us off, Carter?
And then we'll also have some honorable mentions.
Oh, of course, because you have a hard time sticking to just five. Another right. game genie cheat.
All right. My number five was That 70s Show.
Oh, you know, I never got into it, but it's beloved by a lot of people.
It's beloved. I think, you know, there's a play upon the Brady Bunch generation. There's an interesting thing about That 70s Show because it kind of walks the line. There's levels of nostalgia in there. There's also some really serious stuff in there. And, you know, sort of behind the pithy dialogue and the funny comments, there are some very serious things that happens within the show and all within the 70s. And it definitely, it's one of the first things I thought when we came up with this topic was the show. So what is your number five?
Good pick. My number five is Midnight in Paris.
Huh.
Woody Allen's 2011 film. I've seen this movie many, many times, and I'm actually a big fan of a lot of the recent work Woody Allen has done. And the main character, Owen Wilson, is really infatuated and has these romantic ideals of past eras. And it's actually a science fiction film because he goes back in time and he meets some of these people that he... that he's so infatuated with and realizes that the past isn't just he might have been seeing it with this rosy lens and things are actually a little bit different than he thought they would be. And the movie definitely plays on a lot of the ideas we were talking about with Ready Player One. I love the movie. If you haven't seen it, check it out.
Cool. All right, now to number four. I'm curious whether we have a mind meld on this one.
I don't think we're going to have a mind meld today. I don't think it's going to happen.
All right.
It'll be our first one if we don't.
All right, do you want to say your number four then first?
Okay.
Do it!
My number four is Toy Story 3.
Oh, good
no
choice.
Way. Do you have some?
It's in my honorable mentions.
Okay. of the whole Toy Story series, the third one is my favorite. And each movie is playing on nostalgia. Obviously, our love of these toys, childhood, playing with these toys, things like that. But Toy Story 3 is really about these times of change that happen to all of us. And the kind of the dialectic between wanting to hold on to memories and the way things used to be, and also the reality of where you are now and how things are changing.
Right.
It's a great film. I really loved it. The climax of the movie had me really emotional and kind of tearful.
Well, I think that was the purpose. And I mean, you know, the toys are going into the incinerator and all
gosh.
That. Everything is a heartstring puller in that specific film, but also the other ones as well. So no, good choice. It's in my honorable mentions just because I felt it was a little, I don't want to call it too much of a gimme, but I just, there were a few others that I just had to put on this list. So
I get it. I get it.
So my number four is actually the curveball. It is MAME, which is the Multiple Arcade Machine Emulator.
This was your interesting pick.
Yes. And the reason why is because it basically allows people to access all these things that they loved in
the
arcade.
Oasis.
It is the Oasis in some ways. And you're also seeing people using, you're seeing a lot of people who use this, who played arcade games and things like that and bring them back into that state of mind, but you're also, it's also introducing a lot of new people and gamers into this. And I don't know, have you ever attended PAX?
No, you know, I've wanted to, and I know some things happened last year with stuff that we could get into in another episode. I haven't, I want to though.
I've attended PAX East, and one of the really just fun and cool things and, you know, just sort of shows a sense of community and fun in the gamer community that they do at PAX, or at least they did at PAX East. They have this room where people can bring their vintage video games, and they have all the system set up so that you can play them there. So if you want to play, if you want to play Centipede or Super Mario or any of those things, you can play those games, and it's pure, you know, it's an honor system. You go in, you say, hey, do you have this game? And they usually do. And then you can go and play that game. And it's so much fun.
That is really cool.
And so this, you know, I feel like MAME is that room, but you're able to do that at home.
This is a phenomenal pick. Because I've wondered for a long time, do young people now, do kids and teenagers now still enjoy these games from past eras and past generations? And I'm a child psychologist, so I work with a lot of these people. And what I've come to realize is people are discovering good games from the past. And
right.
Just because the graphics might not be what we're used to now, if the game is good, people still love it and play it. And it's technologies like this that have allowed that to happen.
And allow the experience, which is cool.
Good pick. I'm really, really struck by how amazing this pick is. Nicely done.
Number three for me was Dazed and Confused.
Yeah. Good pick.
And I'll say, you know, Dazed and Confused, actually, you know, this, it's an interesting film just because of, I mean, you know, you see a lot of people that end up becoming famous later on in this film, such as, you know, like, It's a bit of an American Graffiti for the 90s, if that makes sense. Like, it, you know, it was released in the 90s, and it was a coming-of-age film. A little bit more of a comedy, obviously, than American Graffiti. But it had, you know, Matthew McConaughey and Parker Posey and Ben Affleck and all these other people in it. And it really is a coming-of-age of these teenagers. And I remember when I saw it, and I saw it in the theater, just thinking how interesting and powerful a film it was. And it did tug on those nostalgia lines a lot, with some of the dialogue and with the music, with some of the things they do. They play mailbox baseball. So that was my, you know, one of the, I tried to put things on my list that just immediately kind of sprung to mind, although admittedly it was hard to pare down this list.
Good pick. We're on number three, right?
Yep.
My number three is, it works on two levels. So it is the music video to Tonight Tonight by the Smashing Pumpkins off their Melancholy and Infinite Sadness album.
Now that, oh gee, I wonder why you're picking that. Interesting.
Yeah.
Little Scott Pilgrim much, Ollie?
Yeah, I know, right? It's the name of the third issue, is it? Scott Pilgrim and the Infinite Sadness?
Yeah. Which is hilarious.
Which is fantastic. So it works on two levels. The reason why I primarily picked it is if you've seen the music video, it's basically an homage to Georges Méliès' original first ever science fiction film, A Trip to the Moon. I mean, A Trip to the Moon is something that it's only like 10, maybe 10 minutes long. It's incredibly short, but it was a first sci-fi film, and it sort of imagined these scenes from Jules Verne's novels and what it would be like to kind of shoot out and explore the moon from this cannon that they get shot out of. And the music video kind of replicates a lot of the moments from that. And I didn't get the connection when I was a teenager and I listened to the song for the first time, but I saw the music video and I was so engaged with the look, the feel, and it felt nostalgic for an era that I didn't even understand.
Which makes me think of Hugo, actually.
Absolutely, which I wonder if that's on your list. So I love the music video. The second layer that it works for me is it reminds me of that time in my life when I was in middle school, and I love that album a lot, and it brings back a lot of nostalgia for me. But the primary reason I picked it was the video.
Cool. All right, on to number two. No mind meld yet.
What was your number three?
Oh, I thought we already did that.
Did we already do yours?
I don't remember. Wait, what did we do? We did my... Yeah, I thought we did my
Days
number three.
Days and Confused?
Days and Confused.
All right, cool.
So number two for me was Wreck-It Ralph.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
Only because... when I watch this film, and it's the gaming things and the references that they make within this film just had me laughing out loud and going, aha, oh my gosh, I can't believe they said that, and things like that. And I actually had to watch it a few times, and there just it was a lot of joy. You could tell that the creators must have had in coming up with some of these ideas and dialogues and little like witty comments, and I truly enjoyed it, and it did leave me with a warm and fuzzy feeling, and also made me want to go back and play video games.
It made me want to immediately play Super Mario Kart,
right?
Or Mario Kart. Good pick. That was a big surprise for me because I didn't see much of the commercials, advertising, trailers for the movie. I ended up catching it on video, and I loved it. Good pick. I love how Bowser is in it, I think.
I know.
M. Bison from Street Fighter. Who's the bad guy from Sonic the Hedgehog? Was it Dr. Robotnik, I think, is in it?
Great. But they also intersplice it with some of the newer games and you know.
Halo.
With Halo. Yeah. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So.
Cool.
All right.
My number two is also, it's a video game. And it's New Super Mario Brothers that came out on Nintendo DS, and it came out back in like 2006. Did you ever play that or the sequel? Have you seen it?
I've seen it though.
Yeah, so it's basically done with modern graphics, but still in a way that's true to the original Mario Brothers game that launched the Nintendo Entertainment System. And it completely brings back all the feels of what it was like to play that original game, and in a way that is still innovative with modern kind of gameplay mechanics. I think it brought back a lot of the resurgence that we've seen in these side-scrolling games that now you can get on Xbox Arcade and PlayStation Arcade and all that kind of stuff. When that game came out, I played it on my friend's DS, loved it so much. I bought a DS just to play this game, played it that whole summer. My partner, Nguyen Lee, she started playing this all summer. We had so much fun playing this game.
All right. Now I kind of want to play this game.
It's great. You'll love it.
My, well,
number one most nostalgic media.
You go first.
Oh, why do I have to go first? Okay. My number one pick is The Wonder Years.
Well, that is excellent. And it's on my honorable mentions. I felt, again, like Toy Story 3, I felt like that. Maybe I was trying to avoid having a mind meld with you today. I don't know. but no, you're absolutely right. That is a series that most certainly looks at that time period in a very... And even the way the narrative is and the, you know, the voiceovers, it's very much that kind of a nostalgic thing. It reminds me a little bit of Pleasantville, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Pleasant.
Just that idea. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Like that kind of a thing.
Yeah. Well, it's a look back at a family that's growing up in the late 60s, early 70s. It's a show that ran from 1988 to 1993. Fred Savage was the main actor in it. And I grew up as a kid watching this with my family. And it takes place in that era, and it uses nostalgia. And I think that's what worked on like my parents' generation. But also for me, the reason I loved it is it was exploring a lot of the ideas and the things that were going on in my life and what it was like to be a kid now. So it also deconstructed some of the idealized views of that time and that era. Really great series. I think it's out on Netflix now, on Netflix streaming. So I think, people can check it out, but, that show gives me so many feels and gives me nostalgia for it reminds me of when I watched it as a kid with my family. So it works on that level, and it's nostalgic in itself of looking back at that era.
Mine, interestingly enough, it's not as far back as The Wonder Years, but my number one was Freaks and Geeks.
Oh, good pick.
Short-lived, obviously.
It's
most
like Firefly.
People,
yeah, it needed to be on for
apparently,
longer.
Apparently, I like all these shows that get canceled.
Yeah.
But basically, for anybody who hasn't seen it and likes geeky things, you should watch it. It is set... in the early 80s, and it's basically following this this main character in junior high, but there's a few different groups of people. It was, honestly, the start of a lot of people you know now, like James Franco, Seth Rogen, is it Busy or Bussy Phillips?
I don't know.
Jason Segel.
Yeah.
Linda Cardellini, and, you know, of course... we've got, you know, Judd Apatow is the mastermind behind this.
Yep.
It was when I remember watching it and just really identifying with some of the things these kids went through. They're coming of age. These are the sort of, especially the junior high kids, they're kind of the dorky kids playing Dungeons and Dragons, and just they're struggling with things, and they're kind of like dealing with puberty, dealing with not being the popular kids. But yet still staying friends, and loyal to each other. And, you know, there's struggles that they deal with, but, I very much liked this show. And it was a little closer to home than, say, The Wonder Years for me, in terms of my growing up. But, I just highly recommend it. I'm not sure if this is on Netflix, but recommend anybody.
It's out there on the internet somewhere. Yeah.
But it's very good. And I think most people who watch it also feel like, why didn't this continue? Because that's how you feel when you finish watching it. So even when you know that it was over too quickly, you still feel that way when you watch it a second time. So
what a fun list. And, you know, we'd love to hear from you about what your favorite nostalgia media are. We've got a few more honorable mentions to fire through. I've got The Perks of Being a Wallflower on my list, the book and the movie. And it is of this era that, again, hits closer to home of, it's a little bit before my time, but a lot of memories come up. And it's also, it deals with some pretty heavy issues, but it's a story that I think anyone will be able to relate to about what it's like to kind of grow up and that transition again from being a teenager to an adult.
I have a couple of, we've mentioned them already, but because they were on your top five. But so I'll mention the ones that we haven't said, but the show Psych They basically play upon a lot of pop culture and the nostalgia factor. So they'll even, the themes of certain shows are about, say, Twin Peaks and things like that. And really fun, a fun way of looking at this kind of thing.
That reminds me of one of my honorable mentions, which is Community.
Right. And then, you know, 13 Going on 30, which I didn't fully like, but it certainly played
that
card. And then the reboots of things like Sherlock, Doctor Who, not necessarily nostalgic, but definitely they're playing upon the people who grew up with these kinds of stories. And it, I think it's also they're accessible, but it's also, you know, they've got the old school generation really enjoying them. And I actually had one song on my honorable mention list.
What is it?
It's called Facebook Friend by Mac the Electrician.
I have not heard this song.
And we'll put a link to it. You can get it on iTunes. But it is basically this narrative about this kid that is unpopular in high school. Like, he's in band and he has this crush on this girl. And, you know, she doesn't, it's not clear whether she treats him badly or not. But apparently she Facebooks friends him, and he's like, no way, I'm not doing this because of all the pain that I have looking back at this, this terrible time that I had growing up, my awkward years and things like that. And so it's more of a negative view, which is why I didn't want to put it on my, my top five, but. Yeah.
Cool.
But there you have it.
I've got Adventureland, The Wedding Singer,
good one.
Transformers, the first movie, Pleasantville, which we talked about, Hugo, which we talked about. I have a few more songs. We're Gonna Be Friends by The White Stripes, Summer of 69 by Bryan Adams, Heroes by David Bowie, and of course, Yesterday by The Beatles.
That's a gimme, Ollie. Cheat.
Just in case. We had a lot of fun on this episode. It's gotten me really nostalgic. I feel like I need to go play video games, listen to awesome music, and hang out with old friends now.
Well, I think that's generally what we should always want to do, right?
Yeah, that's true.
But no, I had a lot of a lot of fun talking about all this. And I honestly, I think this list could probably go on forever.
Yeah, it's probably why this episode's a little bit longer, because it's just, it's been so much, it's nostalgic.
It's like the Super Fantastic Nerd Hour plus 15.
Yeah.
But in any case, we'd love to hear your comments, your favorites, who you think should win in the infinite crossover chamber. And you can definitely give us feedback on superfantasticnerdhour.com.
You can send us a tweet at nerdhour.
Or our personal Twitter accounts. Yeah. Mine is DiePrince.
And I'm at Olima2. You can also check me out as the science fiction psychologist on brainknowsbetter.com.
So until next time, thanks everybody for listening.
And live long and prosper.
Indeed.